conference championships in full force. We've already had four finished, and we go for the marathon this week, obviously, with well above 25 to get decided here. Luke Wynn from Sports Illustrated is the guest, returning and coming to us from a hotel in St. Louis where he was at Arch Madness, which delivered, again, like it always does. We're going to hit on a bunch of Twitter questions, but I do want to start with your experience there. Luke, thanks for coming back on again, man. And what prompted you to do Arch Madness, aside from the fact that obviously this conference tournament almost always lives up to the hype, which is kind of almost a story in itself. But was it that, or was there something else that prompted you to hop on the bird and go over to the Arch?
That a little bit. I mean, I was kind of itching to get it. I like going to the smaller conference tournaments. It's kind of, I always feel like if you make a plan though to write something, it never happens. And so I'll be honest that I went to Arch Madness thinking that I would write which I was gonna get stuff on Wichita State for the magazine, and then probably also write something on Wichita State for the internet. And Wichita State ends up losing the first game when I'm there, being upset. So I ended up writing an Illinois State column and then a feature on Creighton. So, but I'm more than happy to do it. I mean, yeah, honestly, the best games. But it is funny how it's like, if you book a trip, I think it's like the rule of journalism. If you book a trip with a plan to do a story, it's just not going to happen. It's well, yeah, just going to blow up on you.
That is how it goes so often. Can you let listeners know a little bit what it's like? You know, you had a blog post, which I think was technically your first Luke Winterney blog post of the year today. It was a picture post just of the arena there.
Yesterday I had a post. God, are you not reading the blog?
My God, what's up? I'm so
you don't have anything else to do, right? You just sit and read things on the internet.
I know.
It's my Illinois State post from yesterday.
That's pretty
I'm
much
hurt.
My job.
I'm hurt, Matt.
I'm sorry, man.
From Saturday. I did post. I just felt like I was gonna spend Saturday getting stuff for the magazine, but Illinois State won, and so I felt like they were a good enough story. They were a possible bid thief. So I did that. But the blog kind of like crept, you know, it snuck up on people.
Yeah.
I didn't do a major launch post just because whatever.
Well, what was it like down there? I mean, packed crowd all the time. Do you have just like what people would think, like from the outside? I've never been. Hopefully I get to go next year or the year after, but I would assume it's just, you know, throngs of fans well represented from every team from the get-go. Is that an accurate description?
And yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I would say that it's not sold out. I mean, there's definitely space there. I mean, there's energy in that arena, I thought. I mean, I thought that, especially from, you know, like Creighton shows up large. You know, their fans are, they're like the Kentucky fans of the, you know, the Missouri Valley. Like, they show up in numbers. Wichita State fans did too. Illinois State people, I think there were more today than there were the day before because they were surprised. But, yeah, there's a lot of energy. The CAA tournament, which I'm going to go to tomorrow, is more, a little more, maybe feels more intimate, and, you know, and is in the city of one of the teams, and so you kind of have a packed crowd. Like Missouri Valley tournament is a little, it's a little bigger of an event. It's pretty slick though. I mean, I think it's like really well run. I was impressed. I thought it was it's run like an NCAA tournament venue, I would say.
Impressions on Wichita State and Creighton in the wake of this. One of my big takeaways was, I'm still huge on Wichita State, and I think that they should be considered a very strong candidate to reach the second weekend, and I'm kind of glad in a way that they lost, so people will soften on them a little. But do you still think that they're the better team than Creighton?
Yeah, I do. For the tournament, I would definitely pick them to go deeper. I mean, you can't let yourself get distorted by one conference tournament game. And I think that something to remember, I think Garrett Stutz, the center for Wichita State, who was kind of a non-factor in that game they lost, he was pretty sick. He didn't really look himself. I think he'll have a week to get, over a week to get healthy for the tournament. And when he is on, he matters in a game, and he was just kind of like out of it and drained of energy. And so think about it. So I wouldn't erase this game, say that game didn't matter at all, but I think they're a better team than they showed up there. And it's just the fact that, I mean, you know, Creighton could score like crazy when they're making shots. They're, you know, this beautiful team to watch, but they really don't defend that well.
Wichita State does.
I mean, they are, you know, top 20 team defensively nationally. They have the kind of like balanced profile of a team that I think could go deeper in the tournament. They're good on the boards. They don't rely on turning people over as much. Whereas Creighton, I mean, like Creighton could put up, 95-point game in the tournament. If they get hot from three, they could beat anyone, but they're not going to, you know, they're going to go cold at some point, and some team with, you know, a bigger front line that could match up against, you know, Greg Eschenik and McDermott, you know, I think can give them a little bit of trouble, you know, turn them into a team that maybe takes more bad jumpers than kind of feeds McDermott. So I'm not saying that their team will lose in the first round, but I have my reservations that they can make like a deep run.
Did you talk to Parrish at all at the tournament, or did you wisefully just dodge that altogether?
I was forced to talk to him because they put his seat right next to mine.
Oh,
so it was rough. And he showed up, he forgot shoes. So he showed up, it's not that warm here, and he showed up in sandals for Saturday. He claimed that he forgot shoes. So yeah, he showed up in sandals. You know, I think he walked like 10 blocks through St. Louis in sandals, in the cold in sandals.
Gosh.
And so he'd acquired a pair of like gym shoes for today. So he had, you know, he had on a dress shirt, but he had on some random gym shoes that he must have, you know, I don't know. I think he traded for someone on the street or something. I'm not sure what he did, but I talked to him. Otherwise, he was in good spirits.
Well, he always is. And he's always, you know, he's a joy. You'd rather talk to him than Goodman, because Goodman will bend your ear off. I mean, he can't help himself there. So, but it's endearing. We'll get to experience that at the Big East tournament, so something to look forward to. In terms of action from the weekend, the two things, the two results, just real quick that I wanted to touch on. Disheartened is not the right word, but just maybe a little bummed that Iona and Middle Tennessee State both fell in their league tournaments before their final. In fact, Middle Tennessee State, I think it was the quarters, but maybe it was the semis. I wasn't paying crazy attention to that, but regardless of that. They won't play in the tournament. You know, they won't get a chance. I think both of those teams had a really good shot at keeping it interesting at the very least. You know, not knowing matchups, we wouldn't have known what they would have done. And this isn't the typical number one seed from a small conference that bows out early and is jobbed. I think both of these teams had good personnel to kind of just, you know, I think they both would have been a 13 seed, to be honest. And I think they would have kept it interesting. So they both kind of fall and you know, you just kind of wish that the conference tournaments weren't the way they were sometimes when you have teams like that fall. But then again, that's kind of the deal we set up for, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's like we're trading this you know, the chance for a bunch of drama for the possibility that we're going to lose two or three dangerous, you know, sleeper teams from the tournament.
Right.
But really, it's Iona's fault. I mean, they had a team that should have dominated that, you know, I'm not saying that the league is devoid of any other teams, but I mean, the talent gap between Iona and everyone else is pretty huge. And it's their own fault if they can't, you know, they can't take care of business and make the tournament. It was, you know, I mean, they had chances to win. They had a chance to get wins in the non-conference season. They didn't do it, you know, and they're faced with not that hard of a conference tournament and they didn't win it. So, I mean, that's a pretty big disappointment to me because, I mean, that team was, I think they got a lot of press for a team that's not an NIT team from a small conference during the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
You had people covering Momo Jones, people covering Machado. Glover is, you know, an NBA, you know, possible NBA prospect. It's a team that should have been there. So.
It's you're echoing the post I put up. I mean, I kind of took him to the woodshed for.
Are you accusing me of copy?
No, I'm just saying. I'm saying.
I have no time to read today, so.
I know exactly. That's why I'm so giddy over that. But yeah, no, they did. And Wagner's another team that got a ton of press, and they fell short in the NEC. Granted, they weren't the number one, but Robert Morris spoiled us and kind of spared us from another 15 profiles on the Hurleys, who are great guys and coaches on the rise. But I mean, that was just, you know. Every week there was just a new story to tell about those guys. So interesting to see Robert Morris kind of carry on. Moving on, I have a quick question for you. It's regarding your power rankings from last Thursday and the Quincy Miller bit.
I don't remember what I wrote anymore.
No. It's just the Quincy Miller thing. Remember when you had Quincy Miller in like 16 screen grabs of him wearing different clothes and uniform get-ups?
Yeah.
I want to know... Like, what did you notice this on your own? Did you have some obsessive tweeter constantly updating you? How do you even arrive to picking up on his patterns of changing the way he dresses for
I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, it wasn't like I was keeping a database all season of what what his sock color was in every Big 12 game. No, but Baylor, it just started out with the Baylor to me. It's a team that changes its clothes, you know, or just changes what it's wearing, like every game. And it's not just the jersey color. It's like it's just the, you know, shoes, socks, like arm sleeves. I just feel like every time I see Baylor on TV, you know, something is different. And so I started looking at photos of them, and Quincy was like the classic case of this, you know, Baylor, you know, style inconsistency thing. It was just kind of funny. Like, he started the season with one knee brace, and then he has two, and then he has one. And I swore there was a game where he had an arm sleeve, and I couldn't find in a photo, which really hurt, which I was disappointed about. I couldn't find that one. You know, he's got like big t-shirts and small t-shirts and like four different kinds of Adidas. And I just thought it was, I don't know. I just think it's a, there, because there are guys out there in college who have, you know, who are superstitious or, you know, have rituals for games, and they wear the same kind of t-shirt, and he's like the opposite. I just thought it was a funny thing, because I think that you'll find more guys are superstitious about staying the same, you know, keeping the same style thing, whereas I don't, he's born, I bet you could break it down, he has like 25 different style combinations on the year. So that was just me going through a ton of photos after, just to prove a hypothesis that I had.
Well, you know, obviously your power rankings are the most creative weekly college basketball column on the web. How much time, how many hours each week are you putting toward that? You know, counting everything, synergy, research, going online, and all told. I mean, are we talking more than a full day, 24 hours worth in sort of prep and writing for that column?
Oh, for sure. I just spend a stupid amount of time on those things. I mean, it depends. Like, sometimes I'll have other stories due on Wednesday, and then the power rankings are up on Thursday. But I would say that I am putting in a minimum of 24 working hours on them. And a lot of times it involves a complete all-nighter from Wednesday night into Thursday. And I'm not that timely about getting it done sometimes, because I like to review things that happen on Wednesday night and see when they're in synergy. And every blurb there is me following some thought that I had, and sometimes it gets out of control. Like, I'll think, oh, you know, let's track where Ricardo Ralph has made shots, and then it involves me watching like 110 clips or something, and it's just, you know, it's silly. But I don't know. Like I've said a few other times, I mean, college basketball is, I mean, I love it, but you have to kind of be realistic about its place in the sporting world, in online sports news. And it's not like it's a front page sport every day on sports websites during the season. And so the power rankings are the one thing that gets read, that, you know, were my chance to kind of be on the front of the site and get read the most. So I felt like I'll put the most time into those, you know, even if it's not like I really write about where the teams are ranked. It's kind of, I just put a ton of information into that thing, because it's like it's the vehicle for getting it out on the front of the site and having people read it.
No, it's a fun little carnival every Thursday, and I'm sure plenty of listeners are all too aware of it, and you know, make sure that it fits into their weekly annual reading. And if you don't already, I mean, you know, check it out on SI.com. It's fantastic statistical stuff, but plenty of eye and blog candy, so to speak, as well, with some visual things and trends and the occasional snarky commentary and great hardworking stats that are sometimes lifted for the benefit of a television audience. So we all benefit from that. You are working, or you did work on a story for the Mag this week, though, outside of the .com realm. It's going to go live on Tuesday. This is obviously a podcast for a Monday, right? So we get a nice little preview thing. Just, can you tell listeners what the story was, the impetus for it, and what they can look forward to?
Well, I've kind of been fascinated, or I mean, I don't know if they're fascinating to watch, but I've been interested in some of these. We've talked about college basketball slowing down, you know, I mean, you've done a post on that. I mean, other people have, you know, seen college basketball slowing down and, you know, over the last few years over since like the 90s, it's been slowing down. But, my theory, I really believe that it's not necessarily offenses deliberately slowing the game down. It's kind of the rise of these containment type defenses that just take a really long time to break down, and, you know, within the framework of the rules of college basketball, allow certain physical things and no defense for 3 seconds. So, you know, I think that's what's slowing it down. I started investigating that, and the defense that Virginia plays, which is the pack line, that Tony Bennett, you know, he took from his father, Dick, who used it in 1994 to upset Cal in the NCAA tournament. And this was the first, it was the first NCAA tournament game that I ever attended. Wisconsin was in it. It was in that pod, and my dad was a Wisconsin fan, and we went out to Utah, and Green Bay was playing against Cal with Jason Kidd, and Jason Kidd and Lamon Murray were on that team, and they were like, you know, I don't know if everyone remembers them, but they were just this up-tempo team, great scoring team, the kind of team that a whole bunch of people were putting in the Final Four in their brackets, you know, that year as a four, they were four seed, and Dick Bennett comes out with this defense that's basically just building this wall in front of Jason Kidd and filling all of his driving gaps. And, you know, Todd Bozeman made some comment then. It was like every time Jason Kidd tried to drive, it was like there was a team, you know, they were posing for a team picture in the lane. and this fueled one of the, you know, a really big, you know, seismic tournament upset that year. And, you know, Dick Bennett goes on to Wisconsin, takes the team to the Final Four, you know, plays one of the ugliest Final Four games ever that people still talk a ton of, you know, that people still make jokes about. But it was that defense again that got a really, you know, not that talented team to the Final Four. And, you know, they took it to Washington State a little later on. And Virginia's doing it this year. And it's kind of this case of, you know, Virginia's not, I'm not making the case in that story that Virginia is a dominant team nationally. I'm just saying that, you know, this is how some of these disadvantaged teams hang on, and you know Virginia's just hang on by thread. They lost their center Sene. They've got, you know, they're playing a really short rotation. You know, and they're going to be in the NCAA tournament. So the story looks at that, and then also kind of the fact that what's weird is that so Dick Bennett is kind of like the father of, you know, this defense, and but before that, when he was a D3 coach, he was known as this guru of this kind of totally reckless pressure defense that was like the absolute opposite of what these containment defenses were. And he won, you know, he was an NAI or not D3, but he was an NAIA coach at Wisconsin Stevens Point. And he became influential for like playing this defense that, you know, was like all out pressure, swarming one side of the floor, creating a ton of turnovers, all these things. And then, you know, and then when he got to D1, he decided it didn't work. And so he'll make it clear to you. He gets weird. Both of them are really humble people, and they don't like the idea of saying they invented something. So they didn't really, you know, he took pieces of other people's defenses and he made some rules but he's really good at teaching it. So he was good at, you know, coming up with a defense that fit a certain team, and it's been influential in college basketball, and you know it spread. There's other teams using it now. I mean, you can see like principles of it all over the place, and so that's the concept of the story. This is something I'd want to do for a while. I mean, if you hate defenses like this, it's not. I don't think you're going to still hate the story. I'm not saying that they're the greatest thing ever in basketball, but it's kind of a historical basketball thing for something that, you know, has fueled some NCAA tournament upsets. And who knows? I mean, Virginia is going to be an 8 or 9 seed. And
yeah,
if they end up knocking off a number one, you know, I guess it'll look pretty good if they get blown out, whatever. Yeah.
No, I look forward to it. And, you know, I do want to make the distinction for listeners that, you know, Wisconsin now in 2012 and what Virginia is, I mean, those are two different kinds of methods that, you know, fans will clump them in the same, you know, kind of deal.
Because they both play slow.
Right. So, but overall, I mean, the philosophies are certainly a little different. We'll segue to that real quick. Just as you had examined 4 point guards recently, and what they had done in terms of their turnover habits. You know, for good or for bad. You looked at Kendall Marshall, Kentucky's Marcus Teague, Wisconsin's Jordan Taylor, and Kansas's Tyshawn Taylor, and you know that was. You know, this is obviously something that you spent hours upon hours looking at tape on. So, you know, we're kind of rewarded for all that hard work. But what surprised, two questions. One, what surprised you most about what you discovered? And then two, what's the greatest misconception on any level with any of these four guards that the piece unveils and that people kind of need to realize?
I think that it was interesting. Like, if you watch a lot of North Carolina games, you see Kendall Marshall, you know, he makes brilliant assists, but he also has a few, you know, he has a few turnovers every game where he
he thinks he sees something in transition and just like throws it off, you know, throws it off past the backboard or something, you know, with Tyler Zeller with him, you know, who might be barely, you know, couldn't have reached it if, you know, he had the hops, you know, if he had, you know, serious hops, if he had Anthony Davis, you know, reach and jumping ability. But so I was looking at, you know, and Kendall Marshall, it turns out it's pretty crazy. Like he commits, I mean, because, as you know, he's the nation's assist leader, but he also he commits a decent amount of turnovers, and he it's amazing, like 80% of them, you know, over 80% of them are on, are just on bad passes. And he's incredibly in control otherwise. He never
doesn't travel.
He hadn't committed travel all season. He hadn't committed a carrying violation. He'd only had one bad pass where he left his feet and got out of control. And even his offensive fouls aren't the kind, I think, I don't know if I have this right, but I think like he only had five offensive fouls and four of them were just because he uses his right, you know, non-ball hand to push off on some guys while he's dribbling. Not, you know, it's not that reckless drive in the lane, get up in the air, run someone over. So you're looking at a guy who is really, you know, is really in control, but just likes to throw a home run pass here or there. And I guess the question, which, I mean, I'm not saying I have the answer to, is that you wonder, like, what would happen if he were able to just dial back and eliminate a few bad passes every game? Would he, you know, would he be ridiculously good? Would North Carolina be by far the number, you know, would have the number one offense in the country? I don't know if it's possible, though. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, in part they know, I mean, Carolina wanted him to cut down a little bit, but it hasn't really changed. And I think they know that for him to be him, he needs to, you know, he's got to have that mentality of, you know, every time he thinks he sees something, throw the pass, because let's say 80% of the time it's good, you know, it turns out. So that with him, I thought was pretty interesting. I thought that you could see, I don't know if I thought I would see a little clearer improvement in Tyshawn Taylor as the season went on. I mean, he's obviously playing way better scoring, you know, but I didn't.
Right.
He is a little more under control driving in the basket. I thought that the other, I guess the second most interesting thing to me would be with Marquise Teague. You know, no one's going to, I don't think anyone's going to mistake him for like an incredible distributing point guard. He's not, you know, he's just, that's not what he is. But Kentucky seemed to, at some point about midway through the season, acknowledge what he was and adjust their system to fit him the best way. And the way they did it was cutting down on their game pace by, I don't know, it was like four or five, six, maybe even six possessions. It was a lot in basketball. And it really fit him better because a big chunk of his turnovers were coming in transition, you know, just on fast break attempts that maybe were a little too reckless. And once he eliminated those, you know, he became, he's a pretty serviceable point guard. And in Kentucky, the way they run their offense, they don't necessarily need him to do a ton of creating because they don't have, you know, he doesn't need to feed. If you watch Kentucky, like they don't feed the post, they don't need anyone who's really great at feeding the post because they don't really post up. You know, sometimes they do, but for the most part, it's not a post offense at all. You know, you're hitting shooters coming off curls and there's all those handoffs and Teague is, they've started to do more pick and rolls with Davis, but Teague's not great at that yet. Maybe that's like his next. That's kind of the thing I would watch as, you know, maybe in 3S SEC tournament, like making good decisions there, because I think that's an important, going to be an important part of their game in the NCAA tournament. So,
yeah, the possessions went from 70.7 to 62.6. So that's huge, and something that I want to track just during the tournament, because obviously the NCAA tournament teams just go to a half court game, and that's kind of another scary reason why Kentucky should be considered the preeminent favorite, because they've already adjusted to this. And you also mentioned that this is something Cal is just really, really good at, is just taking his point guards, assessing them 10 to 12 games into a season and realizing what their forte is and how his team can be better from there. Couple of Twitter questions here, Luke. Let's give the people what they want here, and that's clearly to indulge their questions. And we'll try and go through these without, you know, pontificating too long. One person asked if 17-1 in the Big East, with the only loss coming without Fab to Notre Dame, is more impressive than Kentucky going 16-0 in the SEC. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that if you're just comparing conference record, I think that what Syracuse did is more impressive. SEC is really top heavy this year. I mean,
and not even as top heavy as we expected, by the way, because there's definitely, I mean, Florida's not as good, and Vanderbilt's not as good, and Alabama's not as good, and Mississippi State, those teams I don't think are as good on as we thought each of them would be, right?
Yeah, so it's just, it's like you didn't even have a team, you know, Florida and Vanderbilt are both decent teams, but you didn't even have a second team that was like a really good, like among the, you know, the national elites that posed, you know, this like impossible home court situation. Whereas, you know, I think that, like, you know, going, you know, the Big East, I think you had, you just had, I think you had tougher road games than Kentucky had. I still am going to pick Kentucky, I think, to win the title instead of Syracuse. But I'm just saying that I the SEC to me was like, unimpressive. I mean, after you get past Florida and Vanderbilt, those games, I don't even, you know, I mean, I know Tennessee has won a few, but it's just not that threatening, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, Alabama should have been better. Mississippi State was, you know, had the early record, but is really, you know, statistically suspect. And I mean, it's impossible. I can't fathom how they have that great of athletes and they have Arnett Moultrie in the middle and their defense is that bad. It's like, what are you doing? I don't know.
And Kentucky won the league by 6 games. And I'm sorry, you can be, you know, 73 UCLA, and it's still, if you're winning by 6 games, it still speaks to the conference. So I am more impressed by Syracuse at 17-1. Although I do think that Calipari will never coach another Kentucky team that'll go 16-0 in conference too. So I wrote on the blog on Sunday that's something to certainly applaud, because I think this will be a kind of a one-time accomplishment. I don't know if that means Cal is gone in 2 years or if he's going to have 3 teams that go 15-1, but it's so rare when we've gone 9 years between it happening, the last one being Kentucky. And on Monday, I'm actually going to have a post examining every conference team that's gone undefeated and what they ultimately did. I just think that's not to be soon to be repeated. All right, let's transition to the Big Ten. We've got a 3-way tie for the championship. So 3 teams get to hang banners and feel good about themselves, with Ohio State beating Michigan State at Michigan State on Sunday. Michigan also gets its first, you know, I don't know if you saw this, it's the first Big Ten title for Michigan since like 86. Doesn't that blow your mind?
Yeah, do they have, I mean, am I wrong? So when they had the Fab Five, they did not.
I have not,
have
see,
Big
that's
Ten
what
title,
I thought.
Or it got taken
yeah,
away.
I don't know. I think it got taken away because I was doing so much freaking writing that I didn't like sit and be like, no, I got to go check this out. So it could technically, you know, in the real world, it's the first one since like 91 or 92 or 93.
It might not be.
It might not be.
It's off the top of my head, but I was 12, and so it's not as, you know.
The question is,
I enjoyed those teams, but I did not keep details. Yeah.
The question is, which one do you like best to go the deepest? And I think there's a legitimate argument for all three here, by the way, because of what Michigan is and how hard they are to prepare for. They're kind of, you know, just a really strong version of Northwestern, not to hate on your alma mater, and we won't get too much into them. But, you know, Northwestern's
a compliment to Northwestern.
Yeah, well, Northwestern's a bitch to prepare for, Michigan even more so. I mean, so I think that all three actually, you could make a case for each of them advancing the furthest, but which one do you like the most? And also taking into effect the fact that Brandon Dawson ripped up his ACL, so he is done for the Spartans.
Wow. Well, that taken into account, I mean, I put all three of these teams in that Magic 8 column I did, which was supposed to be guaranteeing a pool of 8 teams, which would produce the national champion. So that should show you how much I like all three of these teams.
Yep.
But I'm going to lean toward, but I guess I still like Michigan State. I mean, I don't know. They do things in the tournament that are beyond their means almost every year, or not every year, but, you know, when they have a quality team, you know, and a player like Draymond Green, I think, you know, as a senior, I still think that they, you know, that they just outperform your expectations of them every time. Whereas Ohio State has underperformed, you know, I mean, you know, Evan Turner's team didn't get to the Final Four. Last year's team was good enough too, and didn't. So I'm going to bank on Michigan State.
Yeah, a lot of people.
One game past Ohio State.
A lot of people are down on Ohio State now. Maybe not as much so after beating Michigan State on Sunday, but I still feel like the team's got a lot of doubters, which is interesting to see, because, I mean, Buford made a hell of a shot to win the game. I mean, that contested three, Appling was right
beautiful
in his
face. Beautiful shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Was it two, right?
Or was it a two? Yeah, I think you might be right. But it, you know,
I was watching in the press room on Parrish's computer. So it was a small screen. It could have been two or three. But No, I mean, that's a weird thing this year is that I feel like we have two teams, Ohio State and North Carolina, going in the tournament that our perceptions of them are a lot based on what we expected in the preseason. So it's like just because they – I mean, North Carolina now, that you know, with that blowout of Duke, it's changed a little bit. But, you know, if you go back to right before that, just because they weren't what we thought they were going to be in the preseason, which was this dominant number one team, you know, unanimous – or not unanimous, but heavily – at the top of the polls, and then Ohio State in the same way, like, you know, thinking that they would not run away with the Big Ten, but they were the clear number one, you know, not a team that would tie, you know, tie. And that is that affecting our perception of going to the tournament? It's just like the fact that we were underwhelmed from our own expectations, or you know, they might be, they're still really good teams. Like, it's hard though that I wonder if, you know, if you hadn't had crazy expectations on Carolina, if more people would be picking them to win the title.
Well, and I always love to watch the trends and watch how people really buy heavily or sell heavily on a team. And if North Carolina wins the ACC tournament, there's going to be a natural desire to have brackets not be so Kentucky heavy, and so people are really going to like what North Carolina can offer. I don't think that team's going to win a national title. In fact, I'd put them pretty far. I like Syracuse a lot more than I like North Carolina, but I could be biased because I've seen the team in person a couple of times and I like what they do. But I'm just waiting for that to happen. I'm waiting for Carolina to win the ACC, get a one seed, and for a lot of people to fall in love again with them. I think that's sort of an inevitability if it does happen. Louisville, to make a drastic change. Someone wants to know if Louisville can possibly keep shooting this poorly. I think they're going to. I mean, they only shoot 31% from three, effective field goal percentage at 47.8. And I think, listen, this team was awesome to start the year, considering everything that they had to overcome in terms of just, you know, injuries that just bled into the year and suspensions and player eligibility, all that stuff. But at this point, like, I think Louisville is just and watch them go and make the freaking Big East title game again. But to me, I think that this team is just is ripe to be picked off in a 6-11 or 7-10 game.
Yeah, but I think that at this point in the season, you know, you are. I mean, you've taken a lot of shots. You know, it's not like we haven't seen, you know, 1,000 shots or something. You know, by a team or more. I mean, more than 1,000 shots, and I think that the statistics are meaningful at that point. And so if you're, you know, like Butler, people were thinking that they could still make a run to the NCAA tournament, but, you know, eventually their inability to make shots, you know, it was going to catch up with them. And, you know, it did against Valpo. I mean, they're like, Louisville is the Butler of the Big East. It's like, you know, can play defense, but isn't going to be able to shoot itself into, you know, a deep tournament run at this point. Not saying they're, you know, they should be left for dead or anything, but yeah, I think that nothing's going to change. Although, I mean, saying this, that, I mean, what VCU last year in the NCAA tournament, they weren't even that great of, you know, they went nuts and made every three.
Exactly.
It can happen. That's all I'm saying is, like, people want to have explanations for everything. You know, I mean, I believe in the stats that I write about. I believe in the overall, you know, importance of these stats, but, you know, we're talking about six games, you know? That's it. You can go nuts. It can happen. It can't explain everything.
It can, it has, and it will again. All right, we'll wrap up the pod by indulging Jason McIntyre, who runs the Big Lead, who is asked.
Can I ask you a question first before we get to the last one?
Yeah, okay, sure.
Is that, so I'm butting in. Have you ever seen an arena sell lottery tickets from a vending machine before? Have you been at a game?
I have not.
There's vending machines in the Scott Trade Center at Arch Madness with lottery tickets, like different prices. Like, you can buy a $10 lottery ticket in the hallway.
That is weird. Bizarre. That's old school too. I would assume maybe that was popular in like the mid-70s, but I have no idea. So
maybe cigarette machines were probably popular.
What prompted this question? Are you holding a lottery ticket right now?
I took a picture of it. I took a walk around the arena before the game started. I took a picture of an old Nolan Richardson banner where he's got like
coaching
a shirt and a chain. And it's just, oh, he looks amazing. I mean, you wish coaches did that now. And then, and then I saw a lottery ticket vending machine. I didn't buy one, but it was weird. I hadn't seen it before. Anyway. Will and Dull is a Big Lead now.
Yeah, the Big Lead. He's kind of come back at me with this question about four times since the season started.
That's the best.
He wants to know if efficiency stats can help his gambling addiction, and he wants.
Here's the thing: is that I haven't replied because I just don't use Twitter that much. But why is he not aware that Vegas lines match Ken Pomeroy's predictions so close almost every day? If you match up the lines, Ken Pomeroy's predictions based on efficiency with the lines in Vegas, most of them are within a couple points. They're the same thing. I feel like Vegas has gotten more accurate with its lines since efficiency stuff has been published. They look at this stuff and they use it. So I think that they're not two different things. I think they're very well entwined with each other. I believe a ton in efficiency. And so if you see small differences, you know, between a Vegas line that has been pushed by money of a certain, you know, certain team's fans in a certain direction, then, you know, you might find yourself an advantage. But I don't think that there's two schools of thinking.
Right.
Vegas and efficiency. Because I'm serious. There are tons of times where a line is within a point or two of what Ken Pomeroy has on his site. So I just think that if you believe lines are predictive, you believe efficiency is predictive. They aren't, you know, and I think that you aren't going to be able to, you obviously are not going to be able to, just, if you fill out your bracket with just following Pomeroy, you know, that doesn't mean you're going to win your pool. It doesn't happen that way. There are upsets, but I think that you can use the principles of efficiency as sort of like a guiding philosophy to filling out your bracket, knowing things like, you know, these teams with suspect defenses, they don't tend to go, you know, teams tend to get overrated in polls because of offense. So you find, you know, you can look at teams that are overrated in the polls based on good offenses, bad defenses. And over time, a lot of those teams have been upset in the early rounds, you know, teams like Vanderbilt or, right, you know, the Wake Forest teams, Chris Paul, though, I mean, they get upset in the early rounds. It happens a lot. And, you know, and Missouri is a team like that this year. Creighton's a team like that. You know, those are two that I don't think, unless they get really hot, you know, and I just don't see them as, you know, Final Four teams. But so that's what I would say. I just don't think that I think that if you're looking at lines, you're looking at efficiency.
Well, he also wants to know which one single, and I know this is, you know, this isn't necessarily the productive and it's not going to be predictive, but he wants to know which single tempo free stat would you use or deem most important, because he wants to fill out a bracket only by saying this team is better in this stat than this team and advancing every team all the way to the winner. And just, I think, for fun, or maybe it's just going to be some sort of, you know, laboratory experiment that he's going to have a blast with. I mean, which one do you think it is above all others?
So this one here, the efficiency doesn't win a pool or does really poorly, then we can damn it for all time.
I hope that's not his plan, but he wants to know which one you put more stock in than any other one.
Take one swan. You just take, I think, a team's overall efficiency is the one. I mean, I don't think that you should go into a small one of the four factors, because, you know, like offensive rebounding percentage or something like that, because by definition, you know, there are four factors and you can be good at a few of, you know, you don't have to be good at every one of them. You know, it's like you can be good and you can be a really good team at not committing turnovers, but you can shoot, you know, you can shoot a little more poorly than another team because you don't turn the ball over very often. You know, it's like a blend of, you know, it's like your portfolio blending. So you don't want to just pick one of the four factors saying, if I pick the team that commits fewer turnovers all through the tournament, that's going to be a good way to fill out the bracket. It's a bad idea. I just think the efficiency overall, points per, you know, your margin of points per possession scored versus points per possession given up, that's what you should do. And I know that the people act like these stats are kind of like so new age, but really the basketball stats are so much less, are so much more entwined with, like, the, you know, an obvious than the baseball ones. You know, like baseball, you know, you've got, you know, you're trying to, like, figure out, like, an individual player's, you know, role in scoring runs and, you know, and the value of certain hits. But, like, basketball, all we're talking about is how many points a team scores or gives up on the trips down the floor. And there are still people out there who are acting like this is crazy. You know, it's not. It's the simplest thing. It's just, you know, it's better than a box score. It is. There's no way I don't think you can argue that.
All right, so Jason, you're going to want to just look at the Ken Pom front page. Just go off that.
I mean, it's not going to work. You can't predict. You'll have some ideas, but it's not going to work. You're not going to, if each team played each, you know, if every NCAA tournament series was seven games, then I think it would really work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but so we're talking about one game series, so it's not going to work.
And that's why the tournament is so great, ultimately.
That's awesome. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I love when things get proven wrong and unexpected, because without that, what drama, what fun, what surprise do we have, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, let's wrap this pot up, man. It's been a good time chatting with you, catching up. We'll get to do.
This has dragged on way too long.
Tell me about it. For everyone still listening, we really appreciate you indulging us, and thanks for that. You can get Luke on Twitter, although he pops in and out about once a week to plug his power rankings and then goes back into his hole. So. So, at Luke Wynn, that's two N's, obviously, you know that. That's LukeWinn. And then, obviously, SI.com. Look for his story in the magazine this week. And thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me on.